Shigeo Kondo. They call me Shige, class of 1943, College of Arts and Science, where I was a pre-medical studies. I was living in North Jersey, northern New Jersey, in Bergen County, which today is well known as being next to East Rutherford, New Jersey, where the Giants Stadium is. I decided to go into medicine. I was talked into that by my soon-to-be brother-in-law, and he suggested that Cornell would be a good place to go because they had a combined 7 years. They would spend 4 years in Ithaca, and the senior year would be the first year of medical school, which they taught in Ithaca, and then I'd finish up 3 years in New York. I'd never been to Cornell before, of course, and it was quite a trip by car. And I moved into the dormitory, and I always tell people that my mother accompanied me, and she wanted to see the dormitory, but no women are allowed, even mothers, were allowed in the dormitory. That was Lyon Hall. So that was my freshman year. Then I joined the Cosmopolitan Club, and I was able to move in there in my sophomore and junior year, so I had a very nice social life. And that was located in College Town, Bryan Avenue. And I don't know when they closed down, but it was a very active social affair. It was open to everybody, but that's where the foreign students and American students met. A lot of American students would go because they'd like to be part of the international group. We'd maybe go to the movies or hang around at the Willard Strait Hall. At the club, we'd have social events, so we had dances and Sunday afternoon teas. It was very nice. Of course, when I was in the dormitory, I usually ate at Willard Strait Hall, the cafeteria there. I used to spend a dollar a day on food. After Pearl Harbor, we had to turn in all the any cameras and shortwave radios. So I had my family movie camera with me at that time. Happened to have it, a Brownie. So I had about half a roll of film in there. So Don Kerr, who was the counselor for foreign students, and his office was in the Cosmopolitan Club, he said, okay, we'll get down to the police station. But I had to finish up the film. So he took me around campus. So I shot different scenes around the campus, and I got down to the police station, and the chief of police, old buddy with Don Kerr, so he walked in there, and the chief said, oh, you're the one. I got calls from the campus of a suspicious person, Asian, taking pictures of the campus. So I left the camera there, and then after the war, when I went back to Ithaca once, I was able to get the camera. Phys Ed was a requirement, so I liked to track. So I was able to go run with a track team, even though I wasn't good enough to compete, and the coach let me run, so that's where I did most of my exercise. I took pre-medical course, so of course the first year was zoology, that was required. And of course, the other, English and other courses were required for arts and science. It's hard to say who's the favorite professor. There's a lot of interesting professors. I was active in the YMCA when I was in high school. And then during the summer, I was able to work as a counselor at summer camp. After the war started, after my junior year, my father said, don't come home, so you can stay and attend summer school. And I don't know where he got the money, but his business was all frozen. But I started, and then June, I received a telegram from the State Department saying that there's a ship going back. And I'd have take $300 of money and some baggage had shrunk. And I said, well, I don't think I'll go back. So I called home, and my father says, we're going. So I had to clean up my things and clear out of Cornell and went home. And then we prepared. We had to, of course, sell or get rid of all our household things. And we assembled at the Hotel Pennsylvania in New York. Oh, it was 2 months long. We went down, we left New York, I think it was about June 16th, on a Gripsholm. We had about, I think, 1,600 people. These were all the diplomats and business people who had that were not permanent residents. And then we went down to Rio de Janeiro and picked up about 400 Japanese who lived in South America. And then from there we went around the Cape of Good Hope to Lorenzo Marcos, and that's where the diplomatic exchange took place. This was all done through neutral countries. So the ship was a Swedish ship. They were neutral. We went to Portuguese East Africa because that was Portugal owned it, and it was a neutral territory. And then we would exchange there. We got there a few days ahead of the Japanese ship coming, bringing Americans back. We exchanged and then the ship on the way home stopped off in Singapore, spent a few days in Singapore, did some sightseeing, and then made our way up to Yokohama. The trip was, of course, guarded. I mean, they knew exactly where we were. All the lights were on at night, so they knew no submarines would sink us. It was all safe, guaranteed safe passage. My father decided, well, we better learn Japanese because we really hadn't studied any Japanese in America. And there was a graduate student who taught us every day, tried to teach us a little. But it was still difficult. And I had an interesting time. Well, on the Gripsholm was nice because, well, we're all together, more or less equal. But as soon as we got in the Japanese ship, it was almost like being in Japan. We had Japanese food. Military was there. This was supposed to be neutral, but the military seemed to be in command. They tried to indoctrinate us how things were in Japan. Well, my sister was able to greet us, and I forgot where we stayed. I guess we stayed with relatives. And then my father was able to find a place for us to live in Tokyo. 10 days after we arrived, I had my physical exam with my brothers for the Army. So the big thing was to learn Japanese. I went to the physical exam for the Army, and of course, a father had to accompany us because I couldn't understand anything that they were saying. And I got through there. I was drafted into the Army. I think it was about April of 1943. So that was the time that my classmates were graduating. They knew I had pre-med, so they put me into the medical corps as a private. So fortunately, I had an easier job in a way. I was drafted in the Army hospital near where what we call my family registry was. And then I just got inducted there, and then we were sent off to the larger Army camp. It was infantry, and we got our basic training for 3 months. And that's when they tried to straighten us out and make a soldier out of us. And then after that, I went back to the Army hospital, got some more training as a medic, and then I was assigned to the hospital there. Around New Year's of 45, The army formed companies of soldiers. A company was about 120 soldiers, and they had two medics. I was a private, and one lieutenant, and several sergeants. And the soldiers worked in the factory during the day. They were working on lasers, making, I think, starter motors for airplanes. And there was a little clinic in the company where they had nurses. So if anybody needed any help, I mean, or any cuts or anything, the soldiers would go there. So this other fellow and I had absolutely nothing to do. So I don't know, wasted energy or whatever. But then that's when then the air raid started in Tokyo. And that's when other parts of Tokyo were destroyed. And then finally one night, I think in the spring, our area was destroyed with incendiary bombs. And the factory was not far away. And of course, they used a lot of oil in the machinery, and that was all burned. So the army decided to evacuate and build factories out in the country. I was only out in the country for a few days when I got the orders to report to Army Air Force headquarters in Tokyo. And at that time, I was, since they knew I was, could understand English, they were assigned to the listening. The other soldiers, they all could read Morse code or understand, so they were taking down Morse code, listening, and I was listening to the English broadcast. So I'd hear the fellas talking on the radio, and of course they didn't say anything that I could, anything important, or it's in code. But I had a good time. I was a little embarrassed. I would always listen to the American broadcast, the Armed Forces Radio. And at that time, one of the popular programs was the Hit Parade. It was Lucky Strike Hit Parade. Of course, all the foreign broadcasts had no commercials, so you'd always hear music or something, then you'd hear a blank space where the commercial was. So I could keep up with what was going on in the United States. I heard the news. So it was very, in a sense, easy life. We got fed well in the Army compared to citizens who had a shortage of food. The Air Force was right across the street. It was near the Imperial Palace. And there's this big war room that you see in the movies with all the generals sitting around, and you see the big map, and then the air raids that go over there. And I say, so many planes are coming over. I used to think, holy smokes, what am I doing here? I was right in the center of the Imperial headquarters. Tokyo was destroyed around us, and then we had the bombs, and then the atomic bomb fell, and we were wondering what's happening. We didn't know anything about what the atomic bomb was. All the radio said was a new type bomb was dropped. The radio gave very little information, but sometimes you hear from a soldier who traveled through Hiroshima that what the effects of the bombs were. I didn't think that Japan would have, with a military in charge, I didn't think they'd ever surrender. It was announced, suddenly it was announced that everybody would be assembled in the courtyard and would hear the emperor talk. Radios broadcast, and of course at that time it was a very low fidelity radio, and you heard the squeaky voice, which was a recorded voice of the emperor. And it was declaring peace, of course, and we didn't know what to do. And so we were all up in the air and was sitting around. I'll never forget the night. We all had blackouts at that time. Blackout curtains were up. We'd put them, make sure, and you look out and there's total blackout. But then that night, somebody took the blackout curtain down, and we said, "Well, I guess it's peace." So we all started taking down the blackout curtains, and then you look around the city, you can see lights popping up here and there. So that was the end of the war. You remember, you know, that was a great night. So we didn't know what to do, and of course, they had, I guess the military had some things to take care of. They kept me on because they figured I could work as an interpreter. So I didn't do too much. I just remember taking one trip, visiting American headquarters, and I didn't say too much. And then they finally disbanded us. So I went back to the country home where my family, my relatives were. And then I heard that they were looking for people to work in the Army hospital, for the occupation. So I went up to Tokyo. I was able to stay with another family member, and I went to the large Army hospital. It was the old St. Luke's Medical Center, a beautiful brick building which survived the war, and they were looking for anybody to work. So I, of course, interviewed for a job, and I could speak the language, so they hired me right away, and I was assigned to the laboratory there. And I was able to work there. I made good money relative to the Japanese. So that was around December, and then the following spring, one of the technicians, an older man, knew the professor at the medical school. And so this was the, what they call it, charity hospital medical school. So he gave me an introduction, and I was able to get into the medical school. Now, at that time, the curriculum was shortened 1 year because of the war. So when the war ended, they went back to the full 4 year term. So they had a 1 year when they needed students because the pre-med class had moved up. So all my classmates were all Army and Navy officers, and none of them had real pre-med education, maybe one or two, but they were all older fellas, you know, very serious. One of the fellas was a commander in the Navy, and he was talking one day, and he told me he flew over Hawaii and how beautiful it was. And I said, gee, he couldn't fly, have flown. What was he doing? He said he was on the way to Pearl Harbor. So it was quite interesting. So I entered 1946, so I graduated in the spring of 1950. I was accepted at the old Cleveland City Hospital in pathology. It had opening. And I was supposed to be there in July, beginning of the year, but since I had been in the United States before, they had to go back to my records, and I guess my records are buried under the pile of papers in the State Department, so I was delayed about 6 months getting back to the States. So I stayed at Cleveland City Hospital a year and a half, and then I went on to Mount Sinai Hospital in New York for specialty training in pathology. I found out about the reunion, and of course it was the 15th reunion, so I was able to see all my friends. Fred Johnson and were good friends. His family had the vineyard out in western New York State. Later I found out during one of the air raids in Tokyo, I could see the planes bombing the airport. This was about February of 45, and I could see the dive bombers coming in from a distance. And then years later, I found out, I was talking to Fred. He said, Fred Johnson said that he remembered he took off from the aircraft carrier, and then he headed towards Mount Fuji and made a right turn to go to Tokyo to bomb the air, whatever his target was. Mm-hmm. See, during the war, when the air raids first started, one of the officers saw somebody, must have heard me say something, saying that, looking up and wondering if I knew anybody flying. Mm-hmm. And the officer, he yelled at me. He says, "You got to stop thinking about that." Mm-hmm. So that was, Fred Johnson was actually flying, but I could see from a distance. And of course, the war's war, and mm-hmm. beyond your control, so. Well, we were married in 1957. So we had our golden, our children gave us a surprise golden wedding anniversary in 2007. We had four. Unfortunately, the youngest one died at the age of 39 after she was married and living in Hawaii. As you know, the second daughter graduated from Cornell. Mm-hmm. The oldest daughter graduated from Rhode Island School of Design, mm-hmm. and our son graduated from Rutgers. We were living in Maplewood when I was working, and I retired. We moved into a retirement community, but I got tired of the food, and it got to be quite expensive. So we thought, well, I better look around. So I spoke to her daughters, and they said, oh. They looked around and found an apartment in Wellesley. I thought, wow, this would be nice. We'd only take occasional trips to Wellesley to see our grandchildren. But if we lived in Wellesley, we'd see our grandchildren. We could act as babysitters. So it was a very nice situation. And my wife did the cooking, so I enjoyed the food. It's been very pleasant. You'd always speak up about Cornell. Whenever you hear it in the news, you say, that's Cornell. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, if you can help, you have your financially, the school, Cornell can always use financial help. So you try to give what you can. I fell into the job as treasurer after the 15th reunion, the first reunion I went to. Bill Dunn, the treasurer, said when we came back to New York, he said he asked me out to dinner, out to lunch at his fancy business club, and he says, "How'd you like to be treasurer?" I said, "Well, I don't know." He said, "Oh, there's not much to it." So I said, "Okay." So I became treasurer then, and then the next reunion, they voted to make the class treasurer a permanent job. So I became permanent class treasurer, and luckily I was able to attend CAECO meetings in New York. It was great. And of course, attending all the reunions, a lot of the fellows I didn't know, and of course when you come back to reunion, you really make new friends, and it was really worthwhile. And then so you hear about some of the men who, classmates who went on and became very successful. So it was, I always impressed my children, said, "I know so-and-so." I'm very proud to be a Cornellian.